Today's broadcast was originally recorded on October 16th, 2024.
Most Americans don't know how very easy it would be for an unhinged president to use the military against our own citizens.
Yikes. And that's a retired U.S. Major General talking.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Yikes.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yes, I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's Queso, and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN. Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, in Richmond, Virginia on WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet. So on the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. On Monday's Bradcast this week, I talked a little bit about the increasingly violent and fascist rhetoric of Donald Trump as we get closer to Election Day, with voting underway now in, I think, pretty much every state. And as the race seems to be getting tighter and tighter, if you believe the pre-election polling averages, and as Trump is ramping up his rhetoric, not only against migrants in the U.S. now, but toward his own perceived domestic political enemies as well, which he calls, quote, the enemy within. And that he has now suggested he might unleash the nation's military against if he wins another term in office. In response to that episode on Monday over at Daily Kos, a commenter calling himself Perlinator cited a comment from Franklin Delano Roosevelt's January 1, 1944 State of the Union address to Congress at the height of World War II, when FDR warned, quote, "One of the great American industrialists of our day, a man who has rendered yeoman service to his country in this crisis, recently emphasized the grave dangers of rightist reaction in this nation. All clear thinking businessmen share his concern," said FDR. "Indeed, if such reaction should develop, if history were to repeat itself and we were to return to the so-called normalcy of the 1920s, then it is certain that even though we shall have conquered our enemies on the battlefields abroad, we shall have yielded to the spirit of fascism here at home." Well, the nation didn't yield to fascism 80 years ago. In fact, we defeated it abroad, paid a great price for that. And in theory, it was defeated here at home as well, even if 80 years later, it does seem to have gained a lot of popularity of late, as embodied by the Republican presidential candidate, who is marshaling not just the entirety of the Republican Party, but the right-wing domestic extremists who used to be kept out of that party in years past, but who, frankly, seem to be leading it now. We'll be joined by an expert on that subject matter momentarily on today's program. First, Desi Doyen, how
yes.
are you today?
I'm
just
want
to say
but
hello, because
yeah.
I'm on a roll here.
I
got
know.
A lot to get to.
Yes, get to it.
We've got a couple of quick voting news follow-ups today. Most of them seemingly good news for voters and American democracy. To follow up on just one point from yesterday's show, I had reported that with some 90,000 early votes cast before lunch during the first day of early voting in the battleground state of Georgia, officials there said that they expected to break 2020's first day of early voting. That record was 136,000 ballots cast. Well, it turns out by day's end on Tuesday this week, they ended up smashing that record to pieces, more than doubling it, in fact, with more than 300,000 early ballots cast on Tuesday. Now, of course, I can't necessarily tell you right now if that's good news or bad news for Kamala Harris or Donald Trump, but it's certainly good news for democracy in the Peach State, at least, especially as some voters were reporting that the lines to vote there, at least on day one, in a state sort of notorious for long voting lines, at least in certain areas, appeared to be running much quicker than they have in previous years.
Wow, that's a welcome change.
Sarah Tyndall-Gazal, one of the one and only Democrat on Georgia's five-person state elections board, tweeted out yesterday, quote, "We have record turnout and no waiting lines. What gives?" She goes on to explain, "Our new check-in system allows voters to use their driver's license to check in on poll pads, and neither they nor poll workers have to fill out forms by hand. Apparently, this takes the check-in process from a minute or two down to just a few seconds." So apparently, that is what is helping those lines to move much faster this year, after people in previous years in Georgia would eventually leave the lines and just give up on voting because they move so slowly, bottled up in no small part at the check-in desk to vote in Georgia. So that's some good news.
Yeah, as long as those systems hold.
Also out of Georgia on Tuesday evening, a Georgia judge blocked a new rule implemented by the MAGA majority on the Georgia State Election Board that would have required county election workers to hand count the number of ballots cast in each precinct at the end of Election Day, and the critics said threatened to upend the November election by delaying the reporting of results. As we have noted here, many states have long required poll workers to do exactly that at the end of the night, and it causes no delay, not to count the results on those ballots, but just to count the number of the ballots that have been cast.
To reconcile them.
Yes, exactly. And it's also it's a good practice to, you know, document the number of ballots that were cast at a polling place before they are shipped off to the county headquarters. But as I also noted in our coverage of that new rule and a number of other ones as well that were implemented at the last minute by the Georgia State Election Board, it's kind of late in the game to start adding new rules to an election. So, frankly, I'm not surprised that the judge here saw it the same way. Fulton County Superior Court Judge Robert McBurney ruled on Tuesday that the new rule, approved by a pro-Trump majority on the state board, is, quote, "too much, too late," especially as it comes without accompanying instructions on how the rule was to be implemented by county election staffs. The temporary injunction on this rule doesn't mean it can't go into effect eventually, but it delays full consideration of the rule's legality until after the election, which kind of sounds smart. The move was spearheaded by a right-wing board majority that has enacted changes to the state's election rules in recent weeks and approved the hand count requirement, despite a string of public commenters, including local election officials, who begged the board to not do so. Statewide officials, including Republicans, sharply criticized the board's decision. The injunction on it was sought by election officials in suburban Atlanta's Cobb County, by the DNC, and by the state Democratic Party, which had also asked the court to intervene. McBurney's decision came the day after he also ruled that state law does not give county election officials discretion to withhold certification of election results. That ruling was a defeat for Trump allies who had hoped to empower local officials to hold up the outcome of the vote so they could challenge it in the event that Trump lost the state again, as he did in 2020. It can still be challenged in court, but they can't have county election officials just holding up the results, the certification of the results, just to cause chaos. And one more piece of good news for voters today, also a follow-up to a story we covered a few weeks ago on this show with Bolts magazine reporter Alex Burness, as I recall. Nebraska's top election official had no authority to strip voting rights from people convicted of a felony. That, according to the state Supreme Court on Wednesday, in a decision that could add potentially hundreds or even thousands of new voters to the rolls and even help tip the balance on November 5. The order by Republican Secretary of State Bob Evnen could have kept 7,000 or more Nebraskans from voting in the upcoming election. Many of them reside in Nebraska's Omaha-centered 2nd Congressional District, where both the presidency and the makeup of Congress could be at stake. Secretary Evnen had, in July, ordered county election officials in the state to reject the voter registrations of those with felony convictions, citing an opinion that he received from the state attorney general. Both men are Republicans. That opinion, which Evnen had requested from the AG, deemed as unconstitutional a law that was passed this year by the legislature immediately restoring the voting rights of people who have completed the terms of their felony sentences. Nebraska Supreme Court Justice Lindsey Miller Lerman wrote in the high court's ruling criticizing Evnen and Attorney General Mike Hilgers, who is also a Republican, for taking it upon themselves to declare the law unconstitutional. Quote, "Do we want to live in a world where every state employee who has a hunch that a statute is flawed gets to ignore it?" Nebraska, overall, is heavily Republican, but it is one of only two states, along with Maine, which apportion their electoral college votes by congressional district rather than winner-take-all. The Omaha area district has twice awarded its one single electoral vote to Democratic presidential candidates, to Barack Obama in 2008 and again to Joe Biden in 2020. In a 2024 presidential election race that is now shown to be kind of a dead heat, that single electoral vote could end up being decisive. If Kamala Harris wins all of the so-called blue wall states, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, along with all of the other traditionally Democratic states, but loses all of the other battleground states to Trump, well, she would still win the presidency with exactly 270 electoral votes needed to win, but only if she also wins that one electoral vote in Omaha.
Which is why those two top Republican officials decided they were not going to follow the law.
Yep. In that county, that congressional district, Biden had defeated Donald Trump by more than 22,000 votes back in 2020, but Republicans have since redrawn that district to make it more Republican. So every vote is going to matter in Nebraska this year, which is why, yes, Evnen and Hilgers were trying to block the law that was adopted by the bipartisan state legislature. Nebraska also has competitive races this year for one U.S. Senate seat and the 2nd District's U.S. House seat. Two-term Republican Senator Deb Fischer is facing a pretty good challenge, it seems, from the independent senatorial candidate Dan Osborne. He's a former union leader, but he has eschewed both major parties. But he is giving Fischer a real run for her money. And in the House race, Republican Congressman Don Bacon is running against Democratic State Senator Tony Vargas in a rematch of their 2022 election, where Bacon narrowly won with just 51% of the vote that year. So again, every vote in Nebraska is going to count this year. The Attorney General's opinion, which has now been overruled by the state Supreme Court, said that the 2024 law allowing people with felony convictions to vote violated the state constitution and that only the state board of pardons under the control of the executive branch could restore voting rights through pardons, which are exceedingly rare in Nebraska. In fact, that board of pardons includes just three members. You know who they are? Well, Secretary of State Evnen, Attorney General Hilgers, and Republican Governor Jim Pillen, who several times this year has tried to convince the legislature to change the state law to give all of Nebraska's electoral votes to whoever wins the popular vote in the state, as Donald Trump has been pushing them to do for some reason. In its ruling, the Nebraska High Court unanimously agreed to order election officials to enforce the 2024 law, noting that the election is just days away and that the state constitution allows only a supermajority on the state Supreme Court to determine whether a law passed by the legislature is unconstitutional. Felony disenfranchisement laws date to the Jim Crow era and mainly targeted black people, according to experts. But despite a trend toward restoration of those rights, felony disenfranchisement laws around the nation still prevent some 6 million people across the country from being able to vote, according to the ACLU. Those Jim Crow laws in the U.S., believe it or not, were said to have been inspirations for none other than Adolf Hitler during his rise to power in Germany in the early part of the last century. And now, yes, as FDR feared, rightist reactionaries in this nation are again on the rise in support of Donald Trump, who has clearly, to quote FDR, yielded to the spirit of fascism here at home. Domestic extremism expert David Neiwirth joins us to discuss that and much more next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. Here at the broadcast and bradblog.com, we fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. Please help us continue that fight over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Retired General Mark Milley was selected by then-President Donald Trump to serve as his chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the highest-ranking military advisor to the President of the United States. He would serve in that role for more than a year before continuing on in the same role under President Joe Biden until September of last year, when he retired after more than 40 years in the military. During his retirement speech to fellow members of the military, Milley spelled out at least a few of his concerns that seemed at the time pretty clearly to refer to the former president, noting that we in the military, quote, don't take an oath to a king or a queen, to a tyrant or dictator or wannabe dictator.
We don't take an oath to a country. We don't take an oath to a tribe. We don't take an oath to a religion. We don't take an oath to a king or a queen or to a tyrant or a dictator. And we don't take an oath to a wannabe dictator. We don't take an oath to an individual. We take an oath to the Constitution, and we take an oath to the idea that it's America, and we're willing to die to protect it. Every soldier, sailor, airman, Marine, Guardian, and Coast Guardsmen, each of us commits our very life to protect and defend that document, regardless of personal price.
Those remarks resulted in a, quote, nonstop barrage of death threats, according to legendary reporter and author Bob Woodward, that Milley attributed to Trump's political rhetoric and his fixation on retribution for his perceived enemies. One such case occurred after it was reported that Milley testified to the Senate Armed Services Committee that he called his then counterpart in the Chinese government during the January 6, 2021 riot at the U.S. Capitol to reassure him that the country, that the U.S. and its international relations would remain stable no matter what it was that the Chinese government was seeing taking place at the Capitol. He said that Milley said that his task at the time was, quote, to de-escalate. He said, quote, my message again was consistent, calm, steady, de-escalate. We are not going to attack you. After that testimony became public, Trump wrote in a post on a social media platform that if Milley was giving China, quote, a heads up on the thinking of the president of the United States, it would amount to, quote, an act so egregious in times gone by, the punishment would have been death. The threats from Trump's minions thereafter, of course, continued to grow. During his retirement, General Milley thought it was wise to install bulletproof glass and blast-proof curtains at his home. He was a source for Bob Woodward's 2021 book called Peril, sharing his worries about Trump's mental stability and national security decisions, according to excerpts of Woodward's new book called War. Upon seeing Woodward again at a reception in March 2023, he reportedly told the author that his concerns had grown even more dire since then. Quote, I glimpsed it when I talked to you back for Peril, Milley reportedly said, according to the new book. But I now know it. I now know it, he said. No one has ever been as dangerous to this country as Donald Trump, the general told Woodward. Now I realize he's a total fascist. He is the most dangerous person to this country. Donald Trump's own former general calling him a fascist and the most dangerous person in the country. Should we pay attention to that? The Republican candidate for president of the United States is now threatening openly to use the nation's military if he is elected again, not only to round up and deport millions of migrants in the U.S., who he describes as illegal aliens, but against his own perceived personal domestic political enemies, who he now regularly describes during his rallies and media appearances as, quote, the enemy within.
I think the bigger problem is the enemy from within, not even the people that have come in and destroying our country. By the way, totally destroying our country. The towns, the villages, they're being inundated. But I don't think they're the problem in terms of election day. I think the bigger problem are the people from within. We have some very bad people. We have some sick people, radical left lunatics. And I think they're and it should be very easily handled by, if necessary, by National Guard, or if really necessary, by the military, because they can't let that happen. We have two enemies. We have the outside enemy, and then we have the enemy from within. And the enemy from within, in my opinion, is more dangerous than China, Russia, and all these countries.
The enemy from within. That is, of course, as Trump sees it, people like, I guess, General Milley and folks like you. And like me, you know, those radical leftists who are so radical they may not actually vote for Donald Trump in an election. General Milley is hardly the only top-ranking former member of the military trying to warn about the very serious dangers now posed by a second Donald Trump term. Retired Major General Randy Manner spoke with CNN's Laura Coates about Trump's recent suggestion of mobilizing the National Guard and military against Americans. Yes, even active duty military against American citizens, warning that doing so, particularly for a U.S. president who has now been granted by the corrupted far-right U.S. Supreme Court majority, three members of which were appointed by Trump himself, granted him almost complete and absolute criminal immunity to commit any and all crimes, including murder, that anything that he wishes, so long as it's part of his so-called official duties, like his job as commander-in-chief in ultimate charge of the nation's military. Doing so for a U.S. president, explained the retired Major General this week, would not be nearly as difficult as many Americans might still be fooling themselves into imagining.
The vice president is correct. While he's not in office, he cannot do anything to harm Americans directly. If he was to be the commander-in-chief again, everything changes. The Supreme Court has given him immunity. And the threshold for turning the National Guard into his personal police force is quite low. As long as he has a consenting governor, he can authorize the funds to pay them as the commander-in-chief, and he can use the National Guard almost in any way that he wants. And most Americans don't know how very easy it would be for an unhinged president to use the military against our own citizens.
Could he force an unwilling governor to do the same, or he would have to have one complicit?
So it's easy if the governor is complicit. If it's an unwilling governor, he could consider using the act of duty. There are so many things that could be done because these are areas where sane men don't go. It's basically the guardrails of our democracy. The rule of law prevents civilian leaders from going where they should not go. But President Trump is not like any sane leader.
I'll say that again. Longtime independent journalist, blogger, expert on American extremism and domestic terrorism, David Nywert, has also warned about Donald Trump's fascist tendencies, writing, quote, "People who have studied the extremist right as a historical and sociopolitical phenomenon in depth are acutely aware of a simple truth. America has been very, very lucky so far when it comes to fascistic political movements. And now, with the arrival of Donald Trump, that luck may be about to run out. Nor is this phenomenon just a flash in the pan," he writes. "Trump is the logical end result of an endless series of assaults on not just American liberalism, but on small-d democratic institutions themselves, by the American right for many years. It is the long-term creep of radicalization of the right come home to roost. Fascistic elements and tendencies have always been a part of America's DNA," explains Nywert. "Indeed, it can be said that some of the worst traits of fascism in Europe were borrowed from their American exemplars, particularly the eliminationist tendencies manifested first in the form of racial and ethnic segregation and ultimately in genocidal violence. Adolf Hitler acknowledged at various times his admiration for the American genocide against Native Americans, as well as the segregationist policies of the Jim Crow regime in the South on which his Nuremberg race laws were modeled, and the threat of the lynch mob embodied in the Ku Klux Klan. Despite the long-running presence of these elements, though, America has never yet given way to fascism," writes Nywert. That's where Donald Trump comes in. "In many ways," he says, "Trump's fascistic-seeming presidential campaign fills in many of the components of a complex constellation of traits that comprises real fascism. Perhaps the most significant of these is the one component that has been utterly missing previously in American forms of fascism, the charismatic leader around whom the fascist tropes can rally, the one who voices their frustrations and garners followers like flies. What Trump is doing is mustering the latent fascist tendencies in American politics, some of it overtly white supremacist, while the majority of it is the structural racism and white privilege that springs from the nation's extensive white supremacist historical foundations. On his own behalf, he is merrily leading us down the path toward a fascist state. The reality that Trump is not a bona fide fascist himself does not make him any less dangerous, writes Nywert. In some ways, it makes him more so because it disguises the swastika looming in the shadow of the flamboyant orange hair. It camouflages the throng of ravening wolves he's riding in upon. Trump has achieved a kind of Twilight Zone level of influence where he can simply demonize a target with rhetoric suggestive of violent retribution, and his admirers will act out that very suggestion. It's only a step removed from the fascist leader who calls out his paramilitary thugs to engage in violence. America, thanks to Trump, has now reached that fork in the road where it must choose between which path it future lies down, with democracy and its often fumbling ministrations, or with the appealing rule of plutocratic authoritarianism ushered in on a tide of fascistic populism. Trump may not be fascist, concludes Nywert, but he is empowering their existing elements in American society. Even more dangerously, his Tea Party brand of right-wing populism is helping them grow their ranks, along with their potential to recruit by leaps and bounds. Not only that, he is making all of this thuggery and ugliness seem normal. And that is a serious problem. That was just a small part of a lengthy essay from David Nywert at his former blog named Orkinus. He penned that warning for America in November of 2015, long before Trump had even secured his party's nomination to eventually go on and win the presidency in 2016. I came across it while I was preparing to speak with him on today's show, and I found it remarkably prescient and probably all but ignored at the time it was originally written by most of the folks in the corporate mainstream media, as it was just so, you know, radical, describing Donald Trump essentially as a wannabe fascist dictator, almost exactly as Donald Trump's own top general, Mark Milley, would describe Donald Trump years later. Joining us now is David Nywert, award-winning investigative journalist and expert on far-right extremism, whose work has appeared at the Southern Poverty Law Center's Hate Watch blog, and in many mainstream media outlets, as well as blogs like our friends John Amato's Crooks and Liars and Daily Kos. The books that David has written since that 2015 warning about Donald Trump and his then latent fascism include 2017's The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump, 2020's Red Pill, Blue Pill, How to Counteract the Conspiracy Theories That Are Killing Us, and most recently, The Age of Insurrection, The Radical Right's Assault on American Democracy. Mr. Nywert, it has been too many years now, but welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Thanks for having me, Brad. Yeah, I was going to say, I wrote that way back before.
Yeah,
I have changed my views a little since then, but
And I want to talk to you, of course, about the current moment, Milley's warning, Trump's suggestion he might use the military against domestic enemies and so forth. But it sounds to me like you had it pretty close to right back there in 2015 in November, if anything, giving Trump maybe too much of the benefit of the doubt that he was not himself a fascist. I'm sort of wondering, how might what you have learned in the ensuing 9 years since you wrote that piece, which was, by the way, then headlined Donald Trump May Not Be a Fascist, But He Is Leading Us Merrily Down That Path. How have what you have learned might have changed what you wrote about him, what you warned about him back then?
Well, I'd have a motto. The road to fascism is lined with people telling you to stop overreacting. So, I would say, definitely then I would say he wasn't exhibiting all the classic signs of fascism, but I think in the past year the mask has really come off, and especially in the last few months, just the explicit eliminationism, and this, and I think the culmination is these recent comments, you know, identifying Adam Schiff and the Pelosi's as people that he would direct military against.
Yeah.
And these are the enemies within. You know, I did a book, published a book in 2009 called The Eliminationists. It was about this tendency that was rising in American conservative politics about, you know, promoting eliminationism as a solution to the nation's ills. And one of the main attributes that I said about, you know, how do we define eliminationism? And how does it express itself? And, you know, mostly it's all about depicting and dehumanizing and demonizing your enemies to the point that you and try to make them be perceived as objects fit only for elimination, that they're vermin, that they're disease, that they're, you know, scum. But it's also one of the important aspects of this is that all of the rhetoric is also focused on them as being a threat from within, the enemy within, you know, the threat next door. And you know, we're really getting down there with this. It's really being revived, and it's, you know, I mean, we should understand that the anti-lynching campaigns of the early 1900s were very similar in this regard, in the way they demonized Black people and Black men in particular, made them all to be rapists and, or potential rapists, murderers, and which unleashed this vicious eliminations campaign in which thousands of Black men were lynched, summarily lynched. And, you know, that's, so we have actually have a real concrete history of doing this stuff.
It's not
a fantasy to think that it's not something we can say, oh, that never happens here. It has happened here. It has happened here for a long time. We've deliberately forgotten about it.
Yeah. That language, you know, when Black men were identified as murderers and rapists, that's the exact same language that he's using every single day. That Trump is using in his own rallies to describe immigrants, millions of immigrants who need to be rounded up and taken out. And David, it is not just, you know, Nancy Pelosi and Adam Schiff, who he is targeting as the enemy within. It's you. It's me. Yeah. I mean, you know, he talks more about journalists as being the enemy within than almost anything else, I think. You know, I'm hardly the only one to share those concerns, obviously, of folks like General Milley and Major General Randy Manner and folks like Donald Trump's own defense secretary, Mark Esper. And yet, for all the intents and purposes, the election between someone who is telling us what he plans to do, laying out his violent and, yes, fascistic tendencies, is said to be tied according to pre-election polling. So does half of America not believe those warnings? Do they not know about them? Or perhaps most disturbingly, do they know about them and they believe them, but that's exactly what they want in a president in 2024?
Well, I'm certain for you know, about a third of the voting population, the latter is the case. I would say about two thirds of the population is in basic denial about about it, though. You know, I think that the vast majority, both of Democrats and Republicans, you know, and I've known mainstream Republicans all my life. I grew up in Southern Idaho, and you know, they don't acknowledge that this stuff is happening, that this stuff is being said, and that this is stuff is building force. And it would be one thing, I mean, the important thing in all this, Brad, is, you know, it's really easy to focus on what Trump is saying and what he's doing, but is he having that effect on the ground that we fear that he's having? That is, are his millions of MAGA followers following this lead and gearing themselves up to commit murder, or are they just kind of going, yeah, you know, we can bully the libtards with this kind of threatening rhetoric, right? And I do spend a lot of time in their online spaces, or at least I used to.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you that, that this whole civil war idea has been bubbling up for quite some time, but especially so in the last 4 or 5 years. And especially after Trump lost, we saw, you know, fantastic increase in civil war rhetoric. And now it's really plain that, you know, I mean, a lot of these guys have their AR-15s down in their basements and loads of ammunition, and they're all itching to use it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I don't know, you know, a lot of them, you know, most of them are too cowardly to actually do anything. Most of them are just big talkers and gas bags who, you know, they're typical bullies.
Mm-hmm.
Who like to use threatening rhetoric to get their way. But some of them are actually also have screws loose, including the two people who've actually taken shots at Trump. As far as we can tell, they're both right-wing conspiracy theorists.
Yeah.
Right. And that's what he is stirring up, is this, these forces he can't control, of course. And as the assassination attempts suggest, that, you know, when you unleash these kinds of loose cannons on the political landscape, you're not safe either, right? Well, nobody is safe, and that's the thing, is, and that includes all of us. I'm concerned that these guys are going to start shooting at their neighbors after the election. You know,
well, that, you know. And as I was prepping to talk to you, David Nyward, and I was reminded that your 2017 book was titled Alt America, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump, and written amid what was then being described as, you know, the alt-right movement, spearheaded by folks like Steve Bannon and at Breitbart and Alex Jones at InfoWars. It occurred to me that it doesn't even seem like we have an alt-right anymore, David, that the alt-right is now kind of the entire right at this point.
Yeah.
Is that an overstatement?
No, I think that that the Republican Party is now really wholly owned by this element of the right that you know, and we saw that's been really made manifest since January 6th, because the Republican Party utterly failed to redeem itself from that horrific moment and instead just doubled down. And now you still get into debate, you know, Glenn Youngkin can't even acknowledge that Trump lost the 2020 election.
Right.
You know, these, and none of them can. And that's how far down they've gone.
Yeah.
As far down the road they've gone. And that's part of the problem. Yeah. I mean, we saw it happening, really. The Tea Party phenomenon was where this started, because the Tea Party phenomenon was where I started seeing elements, you know, conspiracism, constitutional theories, law enforcement theories, all these sorts of things, from the Patriot militia movement of the 1990s, working their way into the mainstream Republican Party. And that was, you know, that was what the Oath Keepers represented, for instance. And a lot of these other elements. And, you know, it was only within a matter of a year or so that really the, I would go to these Tea Party gatherings out in Montana and Idaho, and they were indistinguishable from the militia gatherings, militia recruitment meetings that I used to cover out there in the 1990s, selling the same materials, selling the same conspiracy theories, selling the same rhetoric. And that was, and I was seeing it take over. And sure enough, you know, Donald Trump declared himself the leader of the Tea Party, and he clearly was the champion of that element as it took over the Republican Party between 2015 and 16.
Which kind of raises an interesting point that I suspect your newest book, The Age of Insurrection, The Radical Right's Assault on American Democracy, may actually speak to. But did Donald Trump create this modern right-wing extremist movement, or did this modern right-wing extremist movement create Donald Trump?
Definitely a symbiotic relationship, but I think more of the latter than the former. No, I mean, honestly, Brad, this I mean, what we're really talking about here as base principles is authoritarianism, right-wing authoritarianism. Mm-hmm. And it began gathering steam really in the early 2000s. That's when I started observing it and reporting on it. And that was why that was the subject of my book, The Eliminationists, was how that, you know, this kind of hate talk was a manifestation of the sort of authoritarian tendencies, as well as the Tea Party afterwards. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, the origins of all that had to do with 9/11, sheer flood tide of fear-mongering that erupted across the country and was sustained for years in the wake of 9/11, just had a really profound effect on the national psyche. We know that authoritarianism exists within most populations as sort of a natural phenomenon, mainly because the whole point of authoritarianism is that you prefer having a single authoritarian leader who can, you know, simply decide things, cut the Gordian knot with one blow, type of decisive leader. And he's not bound by the sort of fumbling ministrations of democracy, as I describe it. And that's the appeal of authoritarianism. And there's within any society, even a fully democratic one, there are people with authoritarian personalities in their personal lives, as well as not to mention their religious lives, all throughout every society. They're usually about 20% of the population, but you can actually increase, it's possible, and I think that that's actually what we've been seeing over the last 25 years, is that it's possible to actually jack up the levels of authoritarian personalities, the authoritarian response within the country by fear-mongering. And so that's why, you know, Trump's whole appeal all along has been fear-mongering. He's fear-mongering about the immigrants. He's fear-mongering about the crime. He's fear-mongering about black people. And he's fear-mongering, you know, whatever it is he can fear-monger on. Because that's how you get people to get into I call an authoritarian crouch.
It works. You know, it works. And I'm glad you mentioned that, you know, this goes back at least to, 2001, because back then I know that folks like you, David, and me, were trying to warn about what seemed to be going on with the Republican Party, that it I don't know about you, but I was, often told, well, that's just because you're a partisan. He's like, no, that's not. I'm not talking about Republican policies. I'm talking about something that seems to be going off the rails in a completely different way, above and beyond policy.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we often manifested itself, especially in those days, in the death of civility. The death of and Democrats have been fooling themselves for the last 20 years, trying to believe that the Republican Party, that you can still, interact with them on a civil level. And they keep bringing the butter knives to a shotgun fight.
Yeah.
You know.
But, and yet, with all of this and all that we know and all that we know about Donald Trump and all that we know that where we have gotten to over these past 25 years, and you've got guys like General Milley saying out and out, quote, he is a walking, talking advertisement of what he is going to try to do.
Yeah.
You still have people, you'll often hear, I had a caller to the show this week, David, actually said as much on air, hey, he was already president. Donald Trump was already president, and he didn't do any of those things that you people keep warning about. Never mind that
he did.
He organized an assault on the U.S. government itself. He targeted his enemies with the Justice Department. But what do you say to those folks who say, well, we already know he's not going to be a fascist dictator because he wasn't one the last time that he served in office for 4 years?
Well, he definitely learned a lot of lessons.
Yep.
I would say you know, his first tenure was a practice run for him. And partly because, I mean, he didn't say he was going to do mass deportation now in 2016 or 2015. Mm-hmm. He's saying it now. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Americans have any idea what that's going to look like. You know, what it's going to look like to have mass police raids on and rounding up Latino families, closing down Latino businesses, taking people away out of the farmers' fields and shipping them all back to, you know, wherever it is that they believe they're from, and breaking up families, you know, and frequently deporting actual citizens. So this is, you know, it's going to be one of those really, if it does actually happen, if Trump wins and he goes about doing the mass deportation now, it's going to make America into a police state. And I don't think Americans are prepared for that, what that's going to look like.
I've sort of been going back and forth or in recent months, thinking about this a lot. I'm not sure what I fear most, Donald Trump winning or Donald Trump losing. He's already signaled once again that he's going to declare victory on November 5, whether he's won or not. He'll claim right. massive fraud in the election if like in 2020 he loses. But this time, you know, they have seeded plans and attorneys and MAGA elected officials all over the country to help them make that case. I'm curious how you think the right wing extremist movement, in as much as you can separate it from the regular old Republican movement at this point, how they are prepared to react if Donald Trump loses again.
Well, you've touched on a lot of it. I think that they have operatives in place and lawyers ready to file lawsuits and that sort of thing. They definitely want to try to manipulate the vote counts. If there are any states, battleground states that have, you know, delayed votes or where the count is close, mm-hmm. and there's, we're going to see the Brooks Brothers riot times 10, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. which was actually what, in a way, what January 6th was about too, mm-hmm. you know, bringing a mob to mm-hmm. vote counting.
Yeah.
situation and using the mob to disrupt the vote counting so that it doesn't continue. And then once that happens, then they're able to shoot the thing over. They'll be able to throw up their hands and say, well, we have to let the courts solve this.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
and this Supreme Court will say, well, we need to let Congress solve it. Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's all the Trump apparatchik. But do you have a fear that the, and again, it's hard to distinguish, but the extremist movement, you know, the ones with the AR-15s, that they will play a part in that post-election response?
Sure, I think so. I mean, there's going to be a lot of them. We're definitely seeing militia types start to organize and prepare for, you know, the so-called constitutional sheriffs are getting ready to do some sort of interference behavior around some of the polls. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, they're mostly in rural areas where it's not going to make a lot of difference. But I think that there's going to be various incidents where they're going to be able to try to gum up the works. I think this time, if nothing else, Democrats are a little bit forewarned that this is going to happen. There are good Democratic attorneys like Mark Elias out there mm-hmm. who are doing a great job of sort of preparing for the various legal strategies that these guys might try to unload on us. Mm-hmm. Again, it's going to come down to, it may come down to their ability to get a mob out to disrupt these vote counts and to stop the vote counting from happening. So
last question here, and I kind of fear your answer, but are there any potential methods to counter this surge in American right-wing extremism? Is there anything that the media could be, should be, ought to be doing better. And I guess that question may have two different answers. You know, one if Trump loses this year, and one if Trump wins. But is there anything that we can do other than, you know, show up, vote, and make sure everyone else we know does the same?
Well, actually, you know, the media plays a central role in all this because they're the ones who are telling us to stop overreacting. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but they're the ones who are constantly, they normalize Trump's behavior, they normalize fascism, they don't call it out. And a lot of this has to do with, ultimately, I think our information environment has been totally polluted and totally warped by 3-4 decades of corporate media ownership. Mm. I think we need to ban corporate ownership of media. I think our democratic discourse depends on having a free and open media. And I think that the more it is at the mercy of a profit motive, where you have companies like Fox News that have discovered that it's actually incredibly profitable to divide the nation and to set people against each other and to coach one half of the country to hate the other half. Mm. That's turned out to be incredibly profitable for them. And I think that we need to do something. I think that we need, as citizens, need to rise up and say, we want to take back our information environment and our democratic discourse so that it's not at the mercy of the profit motive.
Wow. Well, fascinating thought, fascinating idea. Perhaps the topic of our next conversation. It's a good one. It's a good one worth talking about, to ban corporate ownership of media. Now we have something to talk about next time, as if we didn't already. Anyway, David, really great speaking with you. I will point folks, of course, to your Twitter feed. Last time we talked, I think you had been banned for a while on Twitter, but you're back. David Nywert is the name there. And you can also follow his Substack newsletter called The Spy Hop at davidnywert.substack.com. Nywert is spelled N-E-I-W-E-R-T. And, of course, his latest book, The Age of Insurrection, The Radical Right's Assault on American Democracy. It may give you something to read as all hell is breaking loose on November 6th. David, really great speaking with you, sir. Look forward to doing it again soon.
Always a pleasure, Brad.
Thank you, sir. All right, we got to get out.
Yes, that was bracing, though.
Yes, well, you're welcome. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show, want to listen again, or just share it with someone you know, love, or hate, you can do so for free at bradblog.com. That service is made possible by those of you kind enough to hit a donate button over there, or who go straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves, at least throughout this election, however long it lasts. Drop me email on bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, I am The Brad Blog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.